Anna School District for more information.
Anna and I always like to let you know that if your organization has an upcoming fundraiser or wish to provide a service to the community, and be it in a music or art event, workshop, or educational seminar, simply send a short script to WEFT at psa@weft.org, and we'll be sure to include it in our on-air public service announcements. You can also drop a flyer off here at the station or mail it to WEFT, 113 North Market Street, Champaign, Illinois, 61820.
Good evening. You are listening to WEFT 90.1 FM radio. This is the program where we're at, a pre-recorded show. My name is Ben. The date is Monday, March 15th, 2021. It is a damp, cold day today, so I hope you are able to get inside and stay warm and stay out of this not exactly pleasant weather. And of course, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. Coming up here, I have an interview with Jaya Colasetti, who is running for city council in Urbana Ward 4. We talked about justice reform and her involvement with the People's City Council and how the city council can be more transparent. So without further ado, here is that interview. I am speaking with, I hope I pronounced your name right, Jaya Colasetti.
Close, it's Jaya Colasetti.
And you're running for city council, Urbana Ward 4. And Jaya, if you want to just kind of introduce yourself and kind of talk about your background and maybe your professional experience and what you think will be relevant for people to know for your candidacy for city council.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk to you and reach out to folks about my candidacy for alderman or city council for Ward 4 in Urbana. My background is in doing work around sexual and domestic violence, both prevention education as well as in response work. So currently, my day job is as the associate director of the Women's Resources Center at the University of Illinois, where I oversee sexual misconduct prevention education programming and also provide confidential advising for people who've been impacted by sexual violence, domestic violence, stalking, and other related forms of harm. Before joining the University of Illinois in the summer of 2019, I was doing similar work at our local rape crisis center, Rape Advocacy Counseling and Education Services, or folks may know it as RACES. And I was there for around 6 years, held a lot of different roles there, started as a volunteer and then a prevention educator, and stayed on during the state budget impasse as the only full-time employee during the state budget impasse, and then was there as they rebuilt with funding coming through as well. So I had a lot of different roles, wore a lot of different hats while I was at RACES. But that's a little bit about me. Anything else that you want me to cover in that piece?
In terms of, I've been talking a lot about the People's City Council meetings. I know you participated in at least one of those, if not two of those, and they spoke or dealt with issues such as policing, how should the city council go about that, of course. And then not everyone, every candidate exactly was on the same position, yeah. You know, in terms of should either be more justice reform, like in terms of pass more kind of resolutions in terms of keeping the police accountable. And then there, and of course, there's the defunding police, reallocating funds. Can you kind of talk about where you stand on that issue?
Sure. Yeah. So I was part of a couple of those conversations. And I think that that was part of the point with that, of being able to explore the different perspectives. If people were elected to city council, kind of what approach would they take? And certainly we heard a lot of different perspectives, especially around police reform, criminal justice reform more broadly. For me, I think it's really important that as we talk about making changes, that we're also thinking about implementing policy changes. So, you know, if we're saying, hey, the system is not working, then okay, what do we do about it? And I think that Urbana is really poised to make some real changes. We are seeing guidance from the state level that's going to require police departments throughout the state to make some significant changes. Urbana has made some of those changes already, so it's going to be interesting to kind of see where things line up. But then I think it's also important for us to think about what are some of those responsibilities that are in the realm of what the police are doing that maybe belong somewhere else. So one of the big areas that I think it's really important for us to look at is a response to mental health crises that do not involve policing. So thinking about models like we've seen in some of our Western states that are sending out paramedics, mental health professionals, making sure that we have a an option, something that is not leading to more people being incarcerated. I've been talking to residents in Ward 4 and that same conversation about needing an alternative to, you know, incarcerating folks for things that are challenging, right? Things that are causing them harm is really important around substance use as well, right? So folks who are getting arrested, who may need support, may need treatment, we need to be thinking about what are some of those places that it makes sense to shift those resources, shift to people who might be better equipped to answer those kinds of situations. So I think that's a really important piece to me. When we talk about police reform, I think it is important for us to acknowledge that Urbana is not a bubble, right? We're not exempt from what we're seeing at the larger state, national scale. This is something that's a problem in general when we talk about racial inequality, right, in terms of policing. So I think that we need to have serious conversations about how we ensure that as we're making police reform, we're centering folks of color. We're making sure that we're focused on creating a sense of safety that applies to everyone.
So in terms of Urbana's budget, would you be for maybe reducing the money? Because a lot of Urbana's city council, but Urbana's city budget, a big chunk of it anyways, goes to policing. So Where would you stand on, would you be for? I mean, I know that may seem as kind of an extreme position to reallocate those funds, but would you be for that? I mean, I know it's...
No, I think that's a great question, yeah. Right? And I think that this question around, you know, what do people mean by defund the police? I think that term is so confusing to people for exactly this reason. Because I think for a lot of people, the goal is to say like, okay, a large proportion of a lot of cities' budgets are going to the police, right? And there are reasons for that. And there are questions that come up around that as well. Yeah. So I think that as we're talking about shifting some of those resources, some of that might impact the police budget. That would be my expectation. And we've seen that actually in Urbana already. So the city council made a decision to put some money towards a program that is called the One Door Program. I think that's going to be interesting to see if that's the right solution for Urbana. I think that we'll have to kind of see how that all plays out. But some of that funding came from them not filling a position for a police officer, right? So in order to make sure that we have those resources, it is going to take a comprehensive look at where are those funds going. And is that the right place for those funds, right? So absolutely, if we're talking about having mental health professionals respond to situations where someone is having a mental health crisis in the place of law enforcement, I think that that's something that needs to be looked at, right? Of how are we going to fund that? And some of that will be done in collaboration with our local nonprofits, community agencies that are providing that kind of service. But like I said, that's actually something that we are already starting to see happen in Urbana.
And to kind of stay on the topic of going a little bit back about non-emergency, using non-police services for non, I guess, threatening, violent, or any kind of... Now, I believe, if I'm correct on this, there's a program called CESSA, C-E-S-S-A, and this is a non-emergency responses by non-police services. Maybe this is what they use in Western states exactly. Services integrated, non-emergency responses by non-police services integrating into 911. And that could be, I guess, that's a program that can be implemented at the municipal level. So would you be supportive of something like that or similar, very similar to that?
That's a great question. I have to say, I don't know the details of that specific program, so I hesitate to say like, yes, that's the solution. Yeah. But that's a great question. I think that as we're talking about making these changes, it makes sense to look at what models are already out there, but then also make sure that we're having conversations in our community to think about if that's the right fit for us, right? So yes, there are some great models that have been successfully implemented elsewhere. Like I said, I know there are examples in both Oregon and Colorado, but I think that while we can look at what works in those, I think that that is important. I have a public policy background and part of public policy and policy analysis is looking at those different options and saying, okay, here's the evidence that supports this kind of model. Here are the possible challenges. Here's how we would want to address them, right? So I think that having that those models to look at is an important piece of it. But without having that input from the community, without looking specifically at our community's needs, I'm hesitant to say, like, here is the solution because we need more data in order to make a final decision.
In terms of when it comes to
development projects. Mm-hmm. I know there's kind of issues of how, and there was, I believe, complaints for these kind of projects of, you know, how will it affect property value? And there was this complaints about, you know, are the landlords making the property unlivable? Mm-hmm. Are they, and there's this issues of, there was complaints with making it, people were complaining about it being incompatible with, specifically with this Lincoln, the development project on East Lincoln.
Is it the Lincoln, like in the Lincoln-Busey corridor area, that project? They talked about that a couple weeks ago too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think, again, I apologize. I haven't had a chance to see the most recent one because of that family emergency. I know that they were talking about it 2 weeks ago, at least a project on Lincoln. And there are questions about compatibility with the standards for that neighborhood. And there are specific guidelines on any new construction, making sure it fits kind of the existing kind of tone of the area. And I think it is important that, you know, if those standards have been set, that landlords or potential builders are being held to that. In terms of, you know, because if we set like, here are our standards, it's important that that's, you know, based off of input from the community, that we are holding people to what is expected, what is set for the city. If we want to change that, then again, we need to have community input. We need to think about, like, how do we apply that consistently across the board? It shouldn't just be arbitrary or based off of like, I just don't really personally like that, right? Like, we have to have some reason for saying, yes, this is appropriate, or no, this is not. This is an interesting time in terms of development because Urbana is working on a new comprehensive plan for the first time since 2000. And so that's going to set some of those guidelines of building expectations across the city. I know that there's a lot of interest in incentivizing more green initiatives, for example, that might be built into that plan. But for me, I think it's really important that if we're kind of setting standards, that we are holding people to those standards. And that does apply in terms of landlords' responsibilities to their tenants as well. Urbana has some pretty important protections for people to, you know, address potential discrimination in terms of housing, making sure that people have livable standards. And if people are finding that that is not the case for them, they absolutely should be able to reach out to their elected officials, reach out to the city government, and make sure that that's being addressed so that they have a safe place to live.
And in terms of kind of sort of keep on the subject of livable conditions. Right now, there is a moratorium with the, I believe, utilities here in the state of Illinois. It's quite possible, though, that may be lifted, which means power shutoffs will quite possibly continue. And unfortunately, there have been reported cases of water shutoffs still happening. So as, you know, and I've talked with Clarissa Nicholson-Foreman, who is a current city council in Champaign, but she also takes place in People's City Council. And she said, you know, as a member of City Council, you have a platform to speak for, represent your constituents. And, and unfortunately, you know, during these times, constituents may be dealing with things like shutoffs. And, you know, and with Ameren and Illinois American Water, they have kind of a business sort of relationship with the city. How would you speak out for your constituents who may quite possibly be dealing with these types of difficulties with shutoffs, utility shutoffs, you know?
No, that's a really good and important question. I know it has been really disturbing to hear that despite the moratorium, that there have been instances of people still getting utilities shut off. I think that there are a couple different pieces. One is looking at what level of control, what level of power the local city government has in terms of ensuring that that moratorium stays in place for as long as we are in this pandemic. I think that advocating at the state level to make sure, again, those protections remain in place is really important. And then also thinking about how do we connect people to resources who are having those experiences. So I know Cunningham Township, the Regional Planning Commission, have been doing a lot of work to make sure that they are either preventing utilities from being shut off or getting them turned back on. And that, you know, those services are really important past the pandemic as well, right? Like, the pandemic has made these concerns worse for a lot of people, right? Has kind of expanded the number of individuals who are impacted. But I think it's really important to recognize that these are not new problems. These are issues that have been impacting people for a long time, and that the recovery from the pandemic is going to take a long time. So there might be that increased risk, those increased needs, for well beyond the pandemic. So I think, you know, again, looking at local policy initiatives, what kind of power do we have to make sure that we're creating those protections for folks? How do we advocate at the state level? And then also, how do we make sure that people know what resources are available to them so that we're not ending up with situations where people don't have power, don't have water?
In terms of COVID grant money, you know, the city, you know, every time I guess there's a budget passed, you know, currently the House of Representatives, I believe, just signed, approved a bill, and that does include money for a lot of cities. What would be your, if you know, elected city representative, how that money, when, you know, assuming, you know, hopefully Urbana gets a good chunk, it's a good amount of money from this stimulus bill, what would be your prerogative or make sure how that money should be spent in the city of Urbana?
That's a great question. And again, I think it's more complicated than I'd like it to be, right? Like ideally we could just say like, hey, people are hurting. Let's make sure that they get that money, right? Mm. With any grant, especially with federal grants, there are always going to be lots of strings attached, lots of very specific rules of like how that money has to be spent. So I think we're going to learn a lot more about exactly what's in that, how much Urbana will get, and how city will be able to distribute that. And I think it's really important for the city to be transparent about that and make sure that residents, businesses know what kind of funding is available and what kind of help the city can provide to make sure that that money is passing through to individuals. And, you know, again, some of this is for businesses, and we need to make sure that our local businesses that have also been hurt by the pandemic are getting the funds that they need. I know sometimes those applications can be really confusing. So I think that just making it really transparent of what funding is available, how people access it, when it's going to be available, if there are any caps, all of that kind of stuff is going to be really, really important. But, you know, like I said, I would love it if we could directly get the money to the folks who need it most. What we can do is going to be dependent in part on what's in that bill.
How would you make sure that the Urbana City Council is more transparent? I know you So let's just go with that question. Yeah,
that's a great question, right? Okay. I think some of it, to me, it's just as important to say when you don't know something or you can't do something as when you're talking about what you can do, right? I think a lot of times we want to say like, here are all the exciting things we're doing, which is great. But I think it's also important to say, hey, here's where there's an issue. Here's how we're working to address it. So some of it really is just making sure that that's built in to city council meetings, that we're creating other ways for community members to interact with their local government. So, you know, making sure that any kind of, you know, websites, social media, all of those things are kept up to date. But then also thinking about how do we make that information accessible to folks who don't have the technology to make that possible. So thinking about things like, you know, like this, like doing a radio announcement, making sure that we're on local television, making sure that we're, you know, if it's something really important that residents need to know, that we're flyering. But honestly, some of it is just taking that time to say, hey, you all said this is important. Here's where we are with this. This is why we're not moving along farther. I mean, I think about that even in terms of things like infrastructure. You know, I hear from my neighbors all the time of like, hey, we don't have streetlights. Hey, you know, our roads are horrible. Why is it like this? And I was actually reading the current budget for this fiscal year, and it's in there, right? Like, hey, there's a reason for that. We don't have the money. We need to get money from state, from federal grants in order to make that change. Well, we need to be messaging that to people. We need to be saying like, hey, we know this is a problem. Here's how we're working on it to try to resolve it. We're going to keep working on it, but it might take some time. So like I said, some of it's just having that time, taking that time to have a conversation with folks.
Thank you so much, Jaya. Please feel free to ever come back on.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
If you want to know more about Jaya Colasetti and her candidacy for Urbana and where she stands on some of the issues, you can go to jayacolasetti.com, her website, jayacolasetty.com. Again, jayacolasetty.com. And now I will transition to another interview that I did with Brian Dolinar about the issue of COVID-19 in Illinois prisons. I am talking with Brian Dolinar, who has written a few articles on the situation of COVID-19 in Illinois prisons. One was published on Truthout called "New Surge of COVID is Spreading Like Wildfire in Illinois Prisons." And the other one was published on The Progressive called "COVID-19 Coming to a Jail Near You." And Brian, I guess you kind of tell me about this situation with COVID-19 in the Illinois prisons. How did you come about this issue when you wrote these two articles?
Well, hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I sort of monitor the situation in jails and prisons. And, you know, since COVID hit, I haven't been writing much about other issues I cover, like immigration, typically. I've been following ICE raids and not much of that was happening post-COVID. So I, for several months, sort of dormant, you know, like everybody else. And, you know, the only thing to write about was COVID. So been working for an organization called Parole Illinois. I'm the downstate organizer based in Urbana-Champaign. And I, as part of my job, we have contact with a number of people inside Illinois prisons. And so I reached out and was talking to people inside and families on the outside. And, you know, I was just sort of monitoring what was going on, and things were, you know, there was no major crisis, but in the fall of 2020, I heard about the outbreak in Danville Prison, just 30 miles east of here, and there was some 800-900 cases there. At one point, half of the prison had COVID. So it was quite alarming at that point. And so I started gearing up and doing work to try to expose that story. And so it was at a real crisis. I was really provoked to write about it. And throughout the summer, you know, with the post-George Floyd protests that took place, you know, I've been kind of looking at what's going on and paying attention in the jails after people here and elsewhere got put into jail during COVID. And it was as well, I also heard in the fall of 2020 about programs being canceled at the Champaign County Jail. And so I started looking in there as to what was going on in the local jail and did a few local interviews. So I published both of those pieces like right in January in the new year, 2021, and really to try to respond to the major wave of COVID inside jails and prisons.
So when writing on this, essentially reporting on this, how did you like come up, figure out, okay, who do I get in contact with this? I guess how were you able to get in contact and with these people that were in these prisons? Because I imagine that was a bit of a time or difficult to get in touch with these people and how you would communicate with them.
Well, the system itself makes it hard to communicate inside prisons. They charge for phone calls. The time when people can make phone calls, especially during COVID, has been reduced. During the lockdown, guys are inside their cells for 23 hours a day. They would get out, they could make a 20-minute phone call, they could take a shower, and then they're back in their cell. The snail mail was moving very slowly. There's something GTL, the company, has, again, for a fee. You can send kind of emails back and forth. But with Parole Illinois, we are inside outside prison solidarity project. And so we've been communicating inside and outside. So a number of our inside board members like Raul Dorado, like Joe Dole and others, I communicate with regularly. They call me. I get GTL messages. And then we have staff and volunteers who've been collecting. They had a 30-40 messages from inside and a growing list of messages from people inside prison. And then we have a network of family and loved ones on the outside who work with us. And so I interviewed some of them. And so I interviewed about 7 or 8 of them, as well as attorneys. Like I talked to Alan Mills at the Uptown People's Law Center. Mm-hmm. And he's been involved in a suit over health conditions in the Illinois prisons. He was a wealth of information. I talked to Jenny Sobel. She fights for clemency cases for guys inside. And I, as well, just was able to pull some of the IDOC's own information that they keep tallies of online. I did actually talk to the press person for the IDOC. She gave me a little information, confirmed that 3 people had died in the Danville prison. And I think I was the first person to cover those 3 deaths and the dates for those deaths in December, January. But it's really just building relationships, which is so critical to this work, building relationships with those people inside and their family and loved ones. And some of these relationships I've been building over for several years. You know, in my jail story, I spoke to Wayne Colson. His son has been in and out of the system. And I keep in touch with Wayne around town. You know, we see one another at the grocery store and stay in touch. And so Wayne Colson told me his son was in the jail before, during, and well into the COVID outbreak. So I was able to interview this father about his experience of having his son in the jail and his worry of having his son in the jail as COVID was breaking.
And in terms of the condition, with COVID, it's usually, you know, they said they're kept inside in prisons for about 23.5 hours. So really practically all the time, the exception maybe a little bit, maybe hour or so or half hour. And the thing about COVID-19 is that it's actually helpful if you're outside, or at least it can, being inside. And you know, the thing about prison is you're in such a tight space, you're in a small cell. The conditions in prisons haven't been not exactly good, and well, in fact, they've been quite bad. Can you kind of go into options or detail of those conditions?
Yeah, well, one is communication was cut off, visits were cut off during COVID. So there was an immediate lockdown and people were not able to physically see, you know, have visits from their family and loved ones. Over the summer, things loosened up somewhat and people got yard time and, you know, people could be out in the fresh air, which is much safer. But then in the fall, lockdown was re-implemented. And now the vaccine is getting around in the prisons and people are getting vaccinated. And I think just in about all prisons, except for one or two, I know Lawrence is still waiting. Menard, somebody told me just on March 11th, their loved one was getting a shot inside Menard. And so today's the 14th. And so the vaccine is getting around and there's a pressure being put on the Governor Pritzker. There's a group we're affiliated with called End the Illinois Prison Lockdown Coalition. And they just had a press conference on Friday. They're urging the governor to come up with some plan for opening the prisons up for visitations, for yard times, for ending the lockdown. Commissary is also an issue. The guys can order from commissary. It's been significantly curtailed how often they can put in orders from commissary. Commissary is like the grocery store where you can get ramen noodles or socks. And what people can spend has been limited and how often they can visit has been limited. So this is just worsening the conditions and really hard psychologically for the people in prison. And now that things are loosening up, what I talked to somebody I interviewed just yesterday, you know, there's the sense that the guards like it this way. They would like to keep it this way. It lessens their jobs. They don't have to move people around. They just lock people in their cells and keep them there. And so it's really worrisome the way in which the system has used COVID as an excuse for greater punishment and a long isolation.
From what I understand, there were also situations where, now this, I think this was in your Truth Out article, in situations where the water was undrinkable and not, they couldn't really even use it for terms of hygiene, which obviously, you know, with COVID, you need to be able to wash your hands. That's kind of sort of a defense or something that you've been told to do this last year is, you know, wash your hands quite excessively. In one of your articles, that you had the water was essentially undrinkable.
Yeah, this is the situation in Stateville. They have something called the F House. It's the old round house. It's based off the Panopticon. If you read Michel Foucault, the French philosopher, he writes about the Panopticon. And we have one of the last standing Panopticons at Stateville in Illinois here. And it's built in a round circle. They put a guard right in the middle tower. And the guard idea is they can watch people all the time. So there's this constant eye watching people, constant surveillance. And they closed the F House down a few years ago because the conditions were so bad. It was so old and decrepit and it had bad water. And they opened it back up as the COVID unit at Stateville. And, you know, not only do you need water to wash and clean, but you need it to drink. If, you know, fluids are the number one thing you need if you catch COVID. And so guys were forced to purchase their own water that they could drink. The system wasn't even providing water for them. So it is, again, an example of the just total neglect and human rights failure occurred within the Illinois Department of Corrections.
And I know in you're right, in Colorado, that there was a situation where the governor talked about possibly releasing prisoners, maybe those who had, you know, obviously those who maybe had minor charges, nothing exactly serious, but there was like a backlash, or people were outraged that the governor, or that they would be releasing prisoners. And so then the governor had to kind of backtrack on that. I guess I was kind of reading on this, like, you know about our prisons in the United States of America. They're not exactly, you know, good. You know, we have, from what I understand, we incarcerate highest population and incarcerated people. And some of those people are in there because of things like, you know, they just can't make bail. And granted, I give a lot of credit to J.B. Pritzker with the new justice reform bill. We'll see, hopefully that will do work on, you know, getting people who are just in there because of cash, you know, because of cash bail. I think the way I saw it was this as well, kind of hard because, you know, if prisoners and, because, you know, jail guards, because they spend year in prison, as well, they're vulnerable, and they're in such a tight way we treat prisoners. I would argue it's not exactly the best. We could talk all week, really, about our justice system and whether or not it leads to it's more about punishment or rehabilitation. We could do another episode or another. I guess I was just kind of, you know, disappointed that, you know, there was at least in Colorado all this backlash about, you know, you're letting prisoners go, because I was just like, well, I doubt it. They're letting people who are a danger to society. These are probably just not serious offenders. Kind of curious, Brian, if you wanted to kind of maybe, if you had anything to say about that, in terms of about how there was this kind of backlash to people about, at least when this started, about how they thought about Colorado about letting prisoners, because I believe that was in your...
Yeah, in truth, I wrote about sort of what's going on nationwide. And, you know, I try to make the point overall that what is needed in response to COVID is not 23-hour lockdowns. You know, yes, it's about cleaning supplies, but it's fundamentally about letting people out. We have a crisis, ongoing crisis, in the U.S. prison system. The prisons are overcrowded. We've locked up too many people. And COVID has, it would seem, to have sort of shed light on the fact that there's too many people in prison. And the number one way to alleviate the spread of COVID, this real public health emergency, is to let people out of prison. But I think what's we've seen in the last year is how wedded the U.S. is to mass incarceration, that even in light of a major pandemic, even for the sake of public health, the U.S. population, and not just the politicians, the everyday folks, hold on to this belief that keeping people in prison is going to promote safety. When we've seen what has happened over the last year. People, the guards, typically bring COVID in. The guards, who are pretty irresponsible, and most of them Republicans and Trump supporters, bring COVID inside the prisons. It spreads inside the prisons. It then goes back out into the community, infects the community. So many of these rural areas where the prisons are located, where they might have lower transmission rates, the transmission rates are higher because of this coming and going in and out of the prisons, and how the prisons have become a kind of petri dish for spreading COVID. And so some states, there were a couple of states that were better in releasing people, other countries that were better in releasing people. Illinois was fairly bad. Governor Pritzker, despite people urging him to release people, released a few people, but they were mostly already due to get out. And there was a report that showed that most of the people who did get out were white folks. And so, you know, I think politicians are fearful of the backlash, of the ongoing sort of Willie Horton effect, fearful that if they let somebody out, they're going to commit an egregious crime and they'll catch political backlash. And that, those are kind of scare tactics. There are a lot of people in prison who are aged, who have been there for a long time, who could be released without any threat to public safety. You know, lawyers, attorneys I talked to have been putting those cases in front of the governor and in front of the Prison Review Board. And there's still a great reluctance to let people out. So tied to this belief that we have to keep our prisons full, that even the pandemic has not loosened that belief. So it's just, I think, a sign of how much work we still have to do to reverse the trends of mass incarceration. You know, another thing in Colorado was that there was talk about the vaccine, about distributing the vaccine in prisons. And there was some initial launch of a plan for the vaccine in prisons. But then there was a backlash from the governor there, who in effect said, well, why should a murderer get the vaccine before my grandmother should. Again, those kind of scare tactics are used to demonize a segment of the population and continue this system. But to his credit, Governor Pritzker has been forward-thinking in getting the vaccine out in Illinois prisons. And to where, if I understand correct, there was some 10,000 cases of COVID inside prisons last year in Illinois alone. And because keep in mind, we've got about 30,000 people incarcerated now. That means about 1 in 3 in Illinois prisons had COVID tested positive. And so now we're down to about 150 live cases in Illinois prisons. So that's a real step forward. And it's largely due to the mass testing that I wrote about. The IDOC started testing in November, December, January, only after a major crisis. People have been calling for them to implement mass testing elsewhere. They have been, other states have been doing mass testing. New Jersey was doing mass testing. Illinois waited really much too long to implement testing. And once they did, they got it under control. They had the solutions, but again, politics and punishment paradigm took precedence over public health.
Yeah, there's an organization or group called the Illinois Prison Project that you mentioned in your Truth Out article with an attorney named Jennifer Sobel.
That's right.
But she's been working that to get people out of prison who are vulnerable to the COVID virus. And she's filed over 100 appeals for commutations to the governor. And only 22 had been granted. And these were only, you know, who, as you wrote, most of them had been habitual offenders who had been sentenced to natural life because of 3 strike laws. And now that can conclude, you know, armed robbery, you know, accessory to murder, which 22 people granted clemency were elderly and had already spent decades in prisons. If you want to kind of, obviously, that's a long process to get the, out of 100, she only got 22. And that's obviously a long process, right, to get people clemency, which has always, it seems, been a issue in Illinois. I remember even going all the way back to days of Rod Blagojevich, that was always getting clemency with prisoners, always kind of like a long fight, you know, even during these times of COVID-19. So what did she tell, kind of tell you anything about that? Or, well, obviously she did, but about that process, what?
I'm trying to remember now, and there's a few different processes. One is to go to the governor. I believe that's clemency. And the other is commutations, and that is sought out through the IDOC. And if I remember correctly, I'm no attorney, but yeah. When I talked to Jennifer Sobel, she was hopeful that the IDOC, through its own mechanisms, would release people. So there's a few different mechanisms for release. And I think, you know, different advocates, attorneys are seeking different solutions for more release of people, whether that's through the legislature, whether that's through pressuring the governor, whether that's through IDOC. There's different mechanisms for release of people in prison. And, you know, I mean, like in the omnibus package that was passed by Black Caucus and signed by Pritzker, there was some truth in sentencing revisions that were in there. Most of that stuff, though, and we were, you know, we were, my organization, Parole Illinois, was also speaking with members of the Black Caucus and trying to put the issue of parole on the table, but it didn't make it in the omnibus package. Most of what was in the omnibus package is sort of policing issues on the front end. And there's still a great need, I think, for addressing ultimately the endpoint of policing, which is mass incarceration. So, but my organization, Parole Illinois, is trying to restore something of what existed known as parole in Illinois. Parole was abolished in 1978 in Illinois, and that was a process by which people, if you'd served a number of years, a percentage of your time, you could get a hearing in front of the Prisoner Review Board. And if you proved that you had turned your life around, you'd taken college classes, you didn't have any disciplinary tickets, you could get a shot at being released. And so we're trying to implement a parole system in Illinois, something like what existed, but in a modern form, and as a mechanism for mass release. And again, COVID exposes that more than ever. There's need for some mechanism, systematic mechanism of release. So Parole Illinois is now working with Carol Ammons, and represented here in Champaign-Urbana, and as well as with Senator Selena Villanueva, to pass a bill that's SB 2333 for earned discretionary reentry. And we are building a large campaign to bring awareness that people, after they serve long-term sentences. You know, if you do, our belief is that if you do 20 years, and that's a good amount of time, that's the standard in Norway. Other reports say that 20 years is plenty of time. You know, what we have is a situation in Illinois and elsewhere in the country that there's an aging prison population. It's increasingly expensive to keep people, to treat people. You know, if it costs, the numbers vary, if it costs 25, 30,000 a person to keep them in prison, after 55, the numbers go up to, you know, upwards of 50,000 because of the medical needs. You know, if you're just sitting in a box for 20 years, you know, your body breaks down and people have all kinds of health issues, and the state has a responsibility to address those medical needs, and it's expensive. So we're now facing a situation where it's too costly to support and prop up this system of mass incarceration. So there's got to be some giving point, and we're trying to educate the public and change minds and hold up the real possibility for redemption, and that people can turn their lives around. So, you know, there's a need for a real larger public debate about mass incarceration and its failures. The Black Lives Matter movement has brought these issues to the forefront, and now let's talk about defunding the police, and now we need to talk about defunding our prison.
I'm from the St. Louis area. There was a riot at a prison in St. Louis, and it got a lot of news. It kind of came and went, but Cori Bush, who is quite well known, she's a part of the squad in the Democratic or Progressive Party, she brought attention to it and talked about needing to improve, you know, our conditions in prisons. So I hope that this is gonna not be such a taboo, or like, you know, oh, what's, you know, we need to improve. What do you mean we need to improve our conditions, prisons? People need to be, you know, I don't know when you want to say, you know, this whole idea of looking at jails and prisons as punishment. I guess if you want to go, I mean, you can go all the way back to the 90s. You can go back to the 80s with the drug war. I mean, or and it escalated in the 80s under Reagan. Started under Nixon, but as you said, Brian, it seems like it's kind of like an education scenario with the public on how, because you need to get people to understand just how broken, and not to mention just how systemic racism plays a part in our justice system, Americans just view jails and prisons as punishment and not instead of, you know, a way of rehabilitation. So it seems like you're also kind of, you know, in this situation in terms of public perception, it's kind of teaching them, you know, maybe don't look at it as a way of punishment and in a lot of ways, but it just seems like it's just, we have this cruel belief of what prisons and jails should be. That's how you feel, Brian.
Well, yeah, you saw that situation in the St. Louis jail, guys just being frustrated and, you know, enduring these long-term conditions, this extreme isolation at the jail during COVID. And, you know, the sense of fear of guys being locked up so close, you know, guards being really abusive and inconsiderate and cruel and things in St. Louis. And there were other, I was just listening to an interview with Dan Berger last week about the number of protests that have happened in jails across the U.S. to COVID conditions, and people protesting, rioting, holding hunger strikes to protest the worsening conditions, the already bad conditions and the horrible conditions that have existed under COVID. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't think over the last year we really, you know, I was hopeful that there would be some spotlight put on the conditions in jails and prisons and effort to lessen overcrowding, but I think there's been very, very little. You know, if you look around the immigration issue, you know, there's been a great deal of outrage, and that helped to unseat former President Trump. And there's just no real awareness anywhere near that, the conditions, which are probably much more widespread, arguably, the bad conditions. You know, and maybe just this belief, fundamental belief that, well, immigrants are somewhat more innocent, people who are in prison have been convicted of crimes, and it's our kind of mentality in which we want to demonize and cast aside this whole segment of the population, who are largely Black and brown people. So it is fundamentally about punishment, fundamentally about racism, and the prisons have become, they are our modern day form of they're what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow. They are the way in which we've displaced our racist feelings towards a whole underclass, surplus population, and given them the the alternative of prisons and jails for those who do not fit into the capitalist system.
Yeah, very well put. Mention again the articles that you wrote. Again, were the published on truthout.org. New surge of COVID is spreading like wildfire in Illinois prisons. That was under news, prison, and policing on Truthout. I think this was published in January 30th. So the second article was COVID-19 coming to a jail near you, that Brian wrote on January 4th. And that was on progressives.org under in the dispatches section. So Brian, if there's anything else that you wanted to add, the work that's being done, I know there's, I am hopeful a little bit about the seeing the organizations.
Yeah, we have a number of organizations, statewide or locally. You know, here in Champaign-Urbana, we have really great organizations. Like there's the CU Bailout Coalition, my friends at EJP, the Education Justice Project. They're bringing Angela Davis here soon. My friends at First Followers doing reentry work. There's a lot of great organizations, Book to Prisoners in town, that are working around prisons and jails and reentry and policing. So it's important for I think folks to get plugged into organizations, and beyond that, to build relationships with people incarcerated and formerly incarcerated, their families and loved ones who have incredible stories to tell, are wonderful people, have great families, and are really, really inspire me to do this work. So there's a lot of ways to get plugged in. We're really lucky here, I think, in Urbana-Champaign. A lot of avenues of ways we can get plugged in and help to reverse these trends of mass incarceration.
And of course, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. Some public service announcements. The Daily Bread Soup Kitchen, an all-volunteer operation, is located at 116 North 1st Street in Champaign. Their mission is to feed the hungry of Champaign County 7 days a week from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. because 1 in 7 adults and 1 in 5 children in our country are food insecure, and because so many have lost their jobs or experiencing a lack of resources during the coronavirus crisis, the need is right here. While the dining room is closed during this time, good nutritious meals and sack lunches are available for pickups at the front door daily. For more information, visit DailyBreadSoupKitchen.com. Again, the website is DailyBreadSoupKitchen.com. Guests will get good meals and a little certainty in these uncertain times. And again, at the Daily Bread Soup Kitchen, an all-volunteer operation, and they are located at 116 North 1st Street in Champaign. If you are a tenant or a consumer and you need emergency rent assistance, there is the Champaign County Regional Planning Council. You can go to their website if you would like, which is ccrpc.org, and then you go to emergency rent assistance, or ERA. There's also a phone number. The phone number is 877-548-4205. Again, the phone number for the Champaign County Regional Planning Council and for something like emergency rent assistance, that phone number is 877-548-4205, and they will help you with assistance with things such as rent and past due bills. Applications, I believe, start from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Appointments, I believe, can only be made through email. You can see their website for any necessary documents. Again, that's the Champaign County Regional Planning Council. Their website is ccrpc.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, and happy Friday. TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, Jumma Mubarak, whatever it may be for you, it is a beautiful Friday, absolutely beautiful sunny Friday here in Portland. Got kind of cold last night. It was 32 this morning when we got up, but it's going to get up to 60, and I got my appointment for my vaccine, which is coming up in about a week and a half. It's a week from Sunday.
I will get my first shot. Louise got her first shot 2 days ago. So we are hopeful. Sean is in line to get a shot. We got to figure out how to get Nate vaccinated. And I am so looking forward to the day that we can all get back in the studio. Joe Biden gave a speech last night. It was absolutely brilliant. I thought it was up there with some of FDR's fireside chats in terms of his ability to connect with the American people. You know, Obama had soaring rhetoric. Bill Clinton did great wonky things, great wonky speeches. Jimmy Carter, you know, there was substance to what he said. But no Republican president has ever kind of come brought empathy, right? Brought heart to anything. So it was just extraordinary. And I think that we're at the end of an era. And I want to talk about that in just a second. But first, also to tell you that it is Anything Goes Friday. So whatever you want to talk about, we can talk about. Whatever's been gurgling around in your brain for the week, today is the day. And also, the second hour of our program, the entire hour, we're going to do a national town hall meeting with California's Congressman Ro Khanna. He represents the 17th District of California in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and he will be taking your calls for the entire hour in the second hour of our program. So that's what's up. The piece that I published this morning over at HartmanReport.com, there are two Hartman Reports. There's the free podcast, which you can find, you know, wherever you find podcasts. And then there's the daily, my daily writing. Every morning I get up really early and sometimes I do a little bit of work on it, you know, the night before, but and we bang out this, I write up this piece that is typically the same thing as my opening rant or my first hour. And we posted it at HartmanReport.com. You can get that right in your mailbox for free. And there will be eventually a little other content that we'll add to it that there may be a charge for, but everything is free right now and will continue to be, most all of it will continue to be free forever. So that's at HartmanReport.com. And the piece that I published today, you know, I think it really reflects the message that I've been inching towards in my conversations with you, which is that but I haven't just laid it out, and I'm going to do that right now, and then I'll pick up your phone calls for the rest of the hour. And that is that we are at the end of an era. Peter Turchin published a really provocative piece about a decade ago, 10 years ago, in Nature magazine. And in that piece, he pointed out that politics tends to go in roughly 50-year cycles. Sometimes they're as short as 40 years, sometimes they go as long as 60 years, but typically the sweet spot is 50 years. And he pointed out that 1971, well, he didn't point it out, he just referenced that period of time. I pointed out in my piece over at HartmanReport.com that 1971 was when the Powell memo was, you know, written. It was when the entire right mobilized. Within 4 or 5 years of that, you had the Federalist Society created, the Heritage Foundation created, the Charles Koch Foundation became the Cato Institute. State policy networks started growing in every single state. We now have a billionaire-owned and driven political infrastructure with all of these groups that is larger than the Republican Party itself. So I had a great conversation last night with Dean Obadala on his show here on Sirius XM, and we were, you know, talking about this and just laying this out. You know, for example, the tax cut that Trump pushed through back in 2017 had 25% approval among the American public. 25%, according to Quinnipiac. This, and every Republican voted for it. This American Relief Act, which is what Biden is calling it now, has 65% approval, more or less, across the board. And even a majority of Republicans approve of it. It depends on which study you're looking at and when it was done, because Fox News has been pounding on it how horrible it is for, you know, a couple of weeks now. So, you know, they are capable of shifting opinions. But the bottom line is it's very, very popular, and yet every Republican voted against it. And you ask why? Well, because it's not the Republicans who control the Republican Party. It's a handful of right-wing, cranky right-wing billionaires who put their, you know, who use their money to basically buy politics. And I think their day has come to an end. I think this 50-year cycle, since 1971 to 2021, that's 50 years, or from Reagan to today, that's 40 years. Reagan became president in January of 1981. And if you look at those cycles, I think that I'm going out on a limb here, but I really believe that you and I will be having this conversation a year, 2 years, 3 years, certainly 4 or 5 years down the road, looking back and saying, the American Recovery Act and Joe Biden's speech, and I get it, Joe Biden is no Bernie Sanders, but nonetheless, we are going to be looking back at this moment and saying, the American Recovery Act and Joe Biden's speech marked the beginning of the turn, the beginning of the end of the era of Reaganomics. And I point out in my piece over at HartmanReport.com that the thing that really brought it to a head was the Trump presidency. He was so, and the vaccine, for example, is emblematic of that. While the New York Times, as Eric Bullock points out, the New York Times is saying, you know, their headline, Biden got the vaccine rollout humming with Trump's help. Well, no, he got it running over Trump's objections, over Trump's obstruction. Trump gave an absolute screaming disaster to Joe Biden. I mean, the Wall Street Journal, this is back in December. Pfizer had its 100 million dose goal in place until mid-November when it became clear the supply chain hurdles were too great for an end of the year timeline. Did Trump do anything? No, he went playing golf. What Biden has done is he's used the Defense Production Act to give to fill in that supply chain, to give these companies the raw materials that they need and you know, to help people who are administering shots with gloves and vials and well, the vials are for the manufacturers, syringes, things like that. Trump did none of that. You know, instead he kept telling us how wonderful everything is and the vaccine is going to go away any minute. And you'll recall on January 15th, when Trump still had 5 days in office, and he and Jared Kushner had been saying that there was this huge national stockpile of vaccines. And our governor, Kate Brown, here in Oregon, tweeted on January 15th of this year, quote, last night I received disturbing news confirmed to me directly by General Perna of Operation Warp Speed. States will not be receiving increased shipments of vaccines from the national stockpile next week because there is no Federal Reserve of doses. There wasn't even a real federal stockpile. Trump was grifting again. Our governor, Kate Brown, she said, I'm demanding answers from the Trump administration. This was later that day. I am shocked and appalled that they would have set an expectation on which they could not deliver with such grave consequences. This is a deception on a national scale. Oregon seniors, teachers, all of us were depending on the promise of Oregon's share. So, you know, the grift, I think, is what brought it to a head. But I really believe that this 40-year era of Reaganomics has come to an end. There's still a lot of thrashing and, you know, dying going on, and there's a few hangers-on like Joe Manchin on the Democratic side. But I think that even Manchin is starting to come around. So, you think I'm crazy, or you think I'm right?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I go into a little more depth over, you know, the piece over at HartmanReport.com. Anyhow, we'll be picking up your calls right after this. Stick around.
A reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And that will be it for this programming of Where We Are At here on 90.1 FM Radio. If you are out driving in this weather, please be careful. But other than that, I should be back here next week with another show. So take care and have a good night.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan. What an incredible and serious time in world history. Now is the time we need family, neighbors, and hometown radio more than ever. Stay home, wash your hands, and keep it dialed right here for the music of America's front porch, the weekly broadcast of the Woodstock Old Time Radio Hour.
Saturday afternoons at 5, right here on WEFT Champaign.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and on the web at weft.org.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the Urbana Park District and the listeners.